Hello, beautiful people. Welcome to yet another episode of the Option Plus podcast. This episode is a recording from my talk about the digital hills from a conference called the Dark Prague, which used to be called HCPP, Hackers Congress Parallel Police. It happened in Second Culture in Prague. And I'm talking about this concept of digital hills, which you will hear in a moment from the recording of the talk. But I want to show you one more thing that we launched at this conference, and it's very related. We have created this zine, which is called The Dark Forest. And in this zine, you have some art, some poetry. And it's our attempt to create a cypherpunk and lunarpunk zine in the old-fashioned, and maybe define a little bit or try to sculpt or discover what cypherpunk and lunarpunk aesthetics, ideas, memes, and so on is, because I think we are more or less copying the whatever chat memes and conservative memes and maybe some hacker culture and so on, but we are our own thing. So the name of this issue of the Dark Forest zine is "There Were Never Any Real Rules," and it is about digital mountains in a very different way than you will hear from this talk. So it is arguably a little bit long rant, but that's a feature. So if you're interested in getting this, go to darkfo.rest, and this zine will be, I don't know if regular, but this is definitely not the last issue. But what is interesting is that it will probably not be just a physical printed zine, but we have some other forms for the future. So write us. We are on Nostr, and we'll try to get you one of these if you are interested, and I highly recommend it. Not only because it's a collectible, maybe that's also the case, but I think it's a beautiful piece of art, and I would enjoy if you have if you help us discover what cypherpunk aesthetics is. If you would share some of your ideas, maybe have some contributions. They don't have to be in writing. It can be photography, like we have here, or it can be sound, music, or other forms, even objects. But that could be a little bit hard, but we don't rule it out. So check the Dark Forest zine, and let's listen to walking up the digital mountains.
View.
Welcome. Thank you for coming to my talk. There's a pretty good competition in other rooms. I have a first question for you. So it's 2025. Where's cryptoanarchy? Like, what happened? Why is it not everywhere? Or the question is it somewhere? Where are the cypherpunks? Well, you are here, so it's not that there are no cypherpunks. There are cypherpunks, but maybe we should think about where we can find some more cypherpunks and bring more cryptoanarchy. And a few more questions. Where are the parallel societies? Parallel police here is no more. It's the Second Culture. But the answer is also not nowhere. There are many parallel societies in many parts of the world. Where's the counter economy, the agora? Where is Gamma, if you have read the book by Paul Rosenberg, Lodging of Wayfaring Men? Gamma was this decentralized market, and we no longer have so many good decentralized markets. We have many centralized dark markets, but not so many decentralized ones if we are not swapping one token for another. Who is John Galt? I had to include this because most people don't know. So please educate yourself and learn who is John Galt. It's very important for the for your education if you are into cypherpunk and these things. And if we are cypherpunks, are we alone? Are there other people that are doing the same things as we are doing or similar things? Can we get inspired by their strategies, or should we figure out everything ourselves? Then, of course, if we don't find any people like us, we can ask if we are crazy, if this is some kind of a LARPing game that we, you know, do PGP sign our email and use private cryptocurrencies and so on. Are we just, you know, mad? Are we like a weird, I don't know, chess club or some kind of obscure? Are we playing some kind of obscure game? And my final question, which I'll start answering first, is where are the hill tribes of Zomia? Because that will answer many of these questions that I asked before. So I'm glad you asked. No one asked, but it's a rhetorical figure. What the hell is, or who are the hill tribes of Zomia? So first, the word Zomia. Zomia is this area. It can be compared roughly to the size of European Union. It's a little bit smaller, but it's not like a village somewhere. It covers parts of Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, Laos, Myanmar. The extended range goes to Nepal, Bhutan, and four provinces of China. So it's quite a huge area. And it has this special property. You can see these hills that there are quite high mountain ranges. And these hills make it quite hard to get access to people who live there. Especially it used to be the case in the history. So there were and still are people living in this area, and they are somehow special because they figured something out. Something happened to the presentation. There's some, I don't know what it is. Just press something and hopefully it will work. So the hill people. Oh, okay. So I will start with this. I will move it forward. Okay. So this is a Chinese proverb. The mountains are high and the emperor is far away. So traditionally, this proverb relates to corruption, because you had these government officials, whatever form of government there was. And these government officials were responsible for things like tax collection. But if you collect some tax, you don't really need to kick back everything back to the emperor, because the mountains are high and the emperor is far away and they don't really see how much tax you collected. So this was kind of pointing to the fact that even within the government, these mountains and the distance from the center made the enforcement quite hard, and even within the government there was some kind of distance, like cash flow wise and in the sense of applying rules. But I think this could be used also for the hill tribes of Zomia, because this is at the core of their strategy, what they were doing. And I think this is the core of the Cypherpunk strategy as well. It's pretty nicely documented in James Scott's book, The Art of Not Being Governed. And it is 2000 years of successful stateless life. Successful doesn't mean everything was cool all the time. There were times of conflict, times of slave raids, times of forced taxation, forced labor, and so on. But these people in the hills went to the hills for the specific purpose in order to distance themselves from the valley kings that were predominantly based on growing rice, irrigated rice. And there are a few reasons why would you do that. In this area, there are around 100 million people. So it's, as I said, it's not a small village. And they have found a way to be strategically uncontrollable. So I will show you the strategies that they used. One key thing to note that invisibility, or we would say privacy or anonymity these days, is better than confrontation. So what are the strategies? First, the geographical distance. So these are very high mountain peaks, and getting from the valley to the mountain is a big project. It is a big project, especially if you want to come back with some loot called taxes. That's only the first problem is only when there's one mountain, but there can be like five hills. You have to actually go up and down to get to the hill tribe. So just an expedition to collect tax is very costly. And they found a way how to make sure that the costs of this taxing and slaving expedition is higher than any kind of revenue that they could carry back, which we'll get into. So the first way how they made this true is by untaxable agriculture. So as I said, in the Wallis, they were growing irrigated rice, which is the easiest thing in the world to tax. You come there, all the rice is harvested at the same time. So the tax collector comes there, looks at the rice paddy, says, okay, I want 1/3. They know exactly how much rice that is, and they can verify if the farmers paid enough tax. In the hills, they were growing root vegetables, many kinds actually. Imagine potatoes, carrots, but they were like those Asian root vegetables that I don't even know names of. It had a few features. First of all, you don't see it. If it's underground, the person that put it in the ground, that planted it, knows where it is, but you don't see it from like when you look around. So you can hide it basically anywhere you want to grow it. So if there is a tax collection event, no one knows what is the 30% or whatever the rate is of the potatoes, because they have no idea how many potatoes are in the ground. The second thing is that they can be stored there for years. You don't have to harvest them. So if you are making a soup, you come, you take your carrots and stuff out of the ground, you cook soup, and then when you cook another soup, you harvest another soup. So there's no, even in time, there is no, as Frank said, privacy comes from value at rest. So this is a physical value at rest. It's literally underground and invisible, and you just pick it up. So this is very good, because if these tribes are nomadic, if they sense that there is someone that might come and raid their village, they just leave. They come 3 years later. The potatoes are still good in the ground. It's basically a storage. This is strategically better than growing rice. Actually, even in the valleys, rice is not the best thing to grow. There are if you calculate the labor and the land you need, it is better to grow other crops. Rice is taxable, so that's why the Valley Kings were actually banning any other form of agriculture or specific forms of agriculture, especially the root vegetables. So, distance and invisibility. The next strategy, which is very controversial now, but it's my favorite part of the strategy, they would not use written language. So they would not write, even though many of these people could write and they were basically escaping from the rice paddy states to the mountains. They would abandon writing. Why is that? If you write down your family tree, that's a gold mine for someone who wants to either tax or draft you to the military or enslave you, because you say, oh, okay, this guy has five sons of a good age for draft. Let's find them and let's draft them into military. If you don't have these records, if it's just oral traditions, you know, he said, she said, it is much harder for the people to know where something is. There is no record of which potatoes are planted where. People just remember. Another feature of oral traditions is adaptability. So this is very interesting in Bitcoin. Everyone is referring back to Satoshi and interpreting whatever he said because he has written it down. With oral traditions, everyone remembers every event differently. They can draw different conclusions. These are the stories that can adapt to the current situation, and there is no gospel that says, okay, this has to be like this because our grandpa was a wise man and he decided that we are this kind of people with these values. No, you would just adapt to the current situation. So the way they would do it, they would even change their history, their ancestry. So they would, for example, they would come from one Valley kingdom or Valley state, and they would trace their lineage back to them. But then when the king of the Valley state decided that they're going to bring all the descendants back to the state to work on the rice fields, they would say, oh no, we actually came from over there. so they would adapt and they would keep some kind of history, but it's not fixed in words and referred to and constantly argued about, which is I think quite an interesting thing. And I think we need this also in Cypherpunk a little bit more, tell stories what happened and kind of use them as a point of reference, as a fable or as a as a nice story that we can use get a point across. But it's not necessary that it's canonical and true and that it really had to happen. This one is also very important. They were not politically active. So if you are a Valley kingdom and you face opposition saying, oh, this king is illegitimate and we need to get rid of him and put on that guy who comes from our village, the king that is attacked this way has no other option than to spare no expense and crush the opposition. Because if they don't, they're screwed anyway. So even if the cost of attacking the tribe would have negative cost benefit, so it would be at a loss. They would still take the loss rather than be endangered by political opposition. So how they did it is they didn't consider the kings legitimate at all. It's like just a band of bandits that lives down there. And if they come close to us, we figure out if they're friendly or not. And if they are not friendly, we run away. If they're friendly, we trade. But we don't care what happens in the kingdom. Who is the king? What laws they have? You know, if they have health insurance, of if they whatever ride electric cars or burn whatever and release carbon. We don't give a shit. It's their world. This is our world. It is completely separate. We just don't consider those guys legitimate. But we don't get involved in any way. So many people in Cypherpunk want to be politically active. I understand it. But being politically active means that there is going to be pushback. And if you are successful in the political opposition, the pushback will spare no expense to push back, actually. So this is also, I have a Chinese Taoist poem that illustrates this. I have a big tree, the kind they call a stink tree. The trunk is so distorted, so full of knots. No one can get a straight plank out of it. The branches are so crooked, you cannot cut them up in any way that makes sense. There it stands beside the road. No carpenter will even look at it. So this is the happiest tree. It's totally useless. So any attempt at harvesting it and using it for any purpose will be a total waste of time. And this is how the hill tribes try to look in front of any kind of ruler. And I think one of the best ways how a cypherpunk should look like is a homeless backpacker enjoying life, looking at the beach, you know, living from loan, having no income, no money, totally useless for any kind of interaction. So fellow homeless travelers, welcome, become the stinky tree. It's even rooted in the Taoist tradition, so not a new strategy. So if we are looking at the strategies of people who try to not only avoid the state, but be state repellent, meaning they would basically be in a setup where the state would try to avoid any kind of confrontation with them, we need to figure out what is statism actually and what is their strategy. I don't believe that a state is like a cabal of bad people that woke up and decided they are going to, you know, harvest the losers for their produce and tax them and like live like a parasite. It's an evolutionary strategy. So it's not a, like I'm saying that the state is a parasite. But that doesn't mean that we need to consider them morally bad or moralize about it. Like, I don't consider a tapeworm something evil created by some bad people. You know, I look at a cat that's trying to catch a mouse and, you know, it kills the mouse and eats it eventually. That's the result of their evolution. It's not someone's design that they designed this evil creature called a cat that kills the beautiful little mice. So we need to look at it from the evolutionary point of view, which is the states that have managed to operate this strategy and prove their legitimacy have survived. So, oh, we have elections, there's democracy, and you can vote, and you have social security, we provide healthcare, then of course build the roads. If the host that is being harvested for loot thinks that this is a good idea, They might even keep the parasite. It's like there are many parasites that actually provide services. So for example, a bacteriophage would protect the infected bacteria from another viruses. So it even provides a service. It's not like the parasite is all evil. It's just an evolutionary relationship where the people realized that okay, this is acceptable. We can be harvested because we think that the parasite is legitimate. It's there for a reason and it provides us with services. So what happens when you as a person decide, no, I like my sovereignty. I don't want to be harvested by a parasite. I want to get out. What does the parasite do? So it threatens you. If you remove me, you will die or you will be jailed. It motivates. I will protect you from other bad things, and there will be these evil bad people that will that are even worse than me, and so on. And it legitimizes itself. I'm not a parasite, I'm part of you. You are also the state, you know. You vote, you are the state. We are all the state, and things like that. So the people of Zomia, they recognize this. Okay, this is a parasite. We are not part of it. We don't give it any legitimacy. So it's just a band of thugs with like strong sticks, and they will beat us up. So better be careful. But you know, it's not a king. There's like the throne and all the bullshit and the flags and all these things. It doesn't mean anything to us. So if we are looking at the strategies of the parasite, how it evolved and what works, the opposite of it is let's look at people who were successful in not being harvested on and basically be a terrible host to harvest from, like the homeless backpacker that doesn't have any income. And then this dynamic can be this connection can be broken. You can get rid of the parasite, but you need to understand what it's doing. You know, don't tell yourself moralizing stories too much. Just understand what is happening and find how you can safely remove the parasite. If you want it, many people don't want it. What is crucial for freedom is to see through this illusion. You need to understand what is happening, how the state evolved, and what is the evolutionary strategy that you can use to avoid it as well. So in order to know and see if we are successful, it is good to have some metrics. KPIs. KPIs can be specific to one area of life. So, for example, a good metric is a probability of being drafted into an army or any participation in armed conflict. So if a probability of this happening is high, then it's not a very, very positive KPI for your liberty. But it only concerns one area of life. So you might be free for some other reason. Another reason is, for example, a total tax burden. I am now talking about individual metrics. So there are many institutions that do rankings of countries. For example, the Heritage Foundation is building the Index of Economic Freedom, which will tell you, you know, how they tax certain like companies or personal income and so on. But I am talking about individual metrics. So what is my individual tax rate? Like if I don't have any income, I don't care about the income tax because any percent from zero euros, dollars or Czech crowns or Bitcoin or Zcash or anything is zero. So my personal metric of paying income tax can be zero even in tax hell if I don't have any income. So I have to calculate this for myself. It's not enough to look at the Heritage Foundation website. And this is true for all the metrics. So if I'm an 80-year-old woman, probability of being drafted into army is pretty low, even if like some country attacks the place where you live. Another metric of entrepreneurship and how free are you to do business is how many of the products and services I want to supply to the market can I supply as I wish without being harassed. So if I decide I want to build a mobile phone without a USB-C connector, I'm screwed in European Union, so there would be a negative metric. It's also my personal metric. I don't want to build any kind of phone, so this doesn't concern me. But let's say you are a doctor that wants to do stem cell treatment. Okay, can you do it in Switzerland? Can you do it in Czech Republic? Can you do it in Panama? And that gives you your personal metric for how free you are to do as you wish. Of course, freedom of speech. How much of what I want to say can I say without negative consequences, including shadow banning? Amount of bureaucracy. This is nicely measured by the number of hours per year needed to comply with regulations, filling out tax returns, forms, and so on. So if you hate this and you consider this coercion, then the more hours you spend on it, the more coerced you are. And again, it's a personal metric. Maybe you don't need to fill any form at all if you are not doing anything that requires that. So these are by specific areas of life. I wanted to also look at a more general or global metric. For many people here is effectively usable wealth. So you might have 100 bitcoins from some kind of exchange hack. Your effectively used wealth is pretty low because the coins are blacklisted, and if you move them and you're not careful, you are going to jail. If you have some money sitting on some offshore bank account and you want to buy a house in Normiland and the bank wants to know the source of funds, that also lowers your effectively usable wealth. So it's not the balance on your wallets and bank accounts and so on. It is what you can actually use to spend in the world without any problems. So this is, I think, a very good measure of optionality, because effectively usable wealth gives you optionality, and that covers many areas of your life. Your healthcare can be better if your effective usable wealth is higher, your whatever quality of life, and so on. Another one that I like to use, it's from a very obscure libertarian philosophy called Vonu, is mean time to harassment. So basically, there are coercive events or harassments. For example, the police stops you and checks your papers. You consider it harassment, and you measure how often this happens or what is the mean time between these coercive events. The lower the time between these events, the less free you are. So if you are just, living your life and everyone lets you be, then your mean time to harassment will be very high. Of course, this is also a personal metric. If you don't have a car, then no one will stop you because you're not driving a car. Then maybe the coercive event will be something else. But I think this one needs to be adjusted, because a coercive event can be, police stops me and, ask me stupid question and waste 10 minutes of my time and I hate it. And an event could be I write a privacy software and someone jails me for 10 years, which is it would be an event, but it's not comparable. So I would look at impact-weighted average time between harassment events to differentiate between someone taking 10 minutes of my time, which might be acceptable, and, you know, going to jail for selling alcohol in a Muslim country, which is not acceptable, and so on. So all these metrics depend on us, our actions, what we do, how we interact with the society, what we value. Like many people don't value 10 minutes of their time and they're okay being harassed, so they don't need to optimize for this specific event. So this is something we can optimize. So now we have an ancient strategy of people. They were doing some things. We looked at it from the other side of the parasite. We looked at the metrics, what we are actually trying to optimize. Here, let's go around. Let's go also through some metrics of the residents of Zomia traditionally. So non-taxability of crops. I explained how it worked. Probability of being recruited into the army as a worker or as a slave. This was one of the most important things, because it was actually, these kingdoms were slaving kingdoms, and the most scarce resource was actually manpower, the people growing the rice in the fields, or going fighting with another kings, or going for the slaving expeditions. So strategies to minimize or optimize these KPIs: cypherpunk agriculture, oral traditions, geographical inaccessibility. So the cost of control is higher than the proceeds from looting. Political passivity. They would trade if relations are good, because trade is beneficial, and they were actually growing many important producing many important things in the forests, like the spices, which were a good thing to trade with the Westerners. So if the relations are good, they would trade. If the relations were not good, they would not trade, and they would trade with their enemies instead. And because trade improves the wealth of both sides of the trade, it would actually pay off to say, okay, let's leave those crazy people up the hill where they are. We don't care about them. Tell the rice growing population, okay, those guys up there, they're crazy. They can't even read, you know, they're primitive, they're stupid. They don't even have toilets, and so on. And kind of solve it this way. And because they would not politically oppose them, this would work in many situations. They would culturally absolutely deny the legitimacy of the state. They would point out that the state is a parasite, it has nothing to give them, only to take. They would have no hierarchy, which is very important. If they had a chief of a village, someone could convince, you know, they could come to the chief of the village and say, oh, you know, maybe if you integrate with the state, we can make you, you know, like a local governor, you will have like more power. So what they would do instead, if they needed to interact with the state, they would select a chief that would act as their spokesperson. But they would remove even the egalitarian powers that they had. So this person would go to talk to the state, but they would not even have a vote in any like a local decision making. Like their voice is gone. They're just going to talk to the guy, come back, tell what they said, and they would have like no say in what is going on in the village whatsoever. So they flipped it around. So this hierarchy is, if there is someone that represents us, they have even less power than the common man. The state parasite was in many cases, of course, there were many cases where this didn't work. That's why it's a strategy that is part of evolution over 2000 years, but many times this worked, and the state was not able to achieve a positive return on coercion. And the inhabitants of Zomia became state repellent. So basically, they caused the Voli states to avoid them. So it's which is a stronger property than just ignore them. You know, they say, okay, we better not touch these people. It's not worth our time and money and everything like that. All right, so is this escapism or realism? This comes from that gentleman that I'm not going to dox. Like many people, when they think about the state, they moralize, you know, it's illegitimate, I didn't vote for those guys, and who is the prime minister or the president, and they get angry, you know, and now I'm in this situation, I have to fill the form, I'm being harassed, I'm being taxed, and so on. But I think a good point of view on how to treat this is treat it like a feature of nature. You know, the parasite is evolutionary. It's not anyone's design. So it just appeared the same way as a volcano appears. And if you come to the volcano, you can, you know, try to punch it. Oh, you stupid volcano, don't destroy my village. I'm so angry. But that would be kind of stupid. So I think a better approach is to say, oh, okay, volcano, it's going to erupt. Probably I should fuck off somewhere else, chill out for a while. And when the lava gets colder, I might come back. Maybe I'll find some potato fries in the in the ground, and maybe I can rebuild. But there is absolutely no point in fighting the volcano. It's just it's just there. It does what volcano does. So basically, retreat, survive, protect resources and people, and after shit stops hitting the fan, you come back, you rebuild, and you're fine. So, like many people say, you know, we need to fight, we need to make everything better, and you know, they're attacking us and whoever they is, and we need to be involved in this fight. No, you don't. It's just a force of nature that happens, and your goal is to protect yourself, your people around you, your friends, your family, and live a good life, and don't fight the fights which you can't win. So it's about adaptation and long-term survival. So back to the cypherpunks, what does it have to do with crypto anarchy? So the hill doesn't work that well. We have helicopters now, so no one has to actually climb to the hill. The hill tribes are actually still in Zomia. I visited a few times this area, and you can actually go to the mountains and they still live there. One thing that is interesting, it's not a tribe that is of the same ethnicity. These villages would have people that speak three or more languages at the same time. So it is really selection of people who wanted to escape the Voli states. So what should we do? We should make surveillance, censorship and blocking more expensive than the profits from these activities. Fortunately, instead of the hill, we have mathematics, which is on our side. We have, for example, cryptographic identity, keeper generation, which is an account without permission, so we cannot be easily blocked. No one can, you know, cancel our Nostr account or cancel our Zcash shielded address or Bitcoin address. No one can cancel our Onion address. They can, of course, stop our domain name registration, Facebook account, bank accounts can be frozen. But with cryptographic identity, we can actually be protected because mathematics is on our side. So that's one part of the digital hill. So how do we make the cost of attack higher than the loot? I think the equation is How expensive is it to attack versus protect against the attack? So attack versus defense. So a parasite shouldn't have a positive return of on coercion. This is changing over time. So, for example, during the communism in Czechoslovakia, Eastern Germany, and many other European countries, you would have secret police that would survey people, but that is super costly. You need to pick up, and then you need to listen to people mostly talking about total bullshit, with like every now and then you would get some information. So mass surveillance on the level that we have now was super expensive. We switched to electronic communication, which was not encrypted. Suddenly, just collecting a lot of data and doing just a basic full text search became quite cheap. But then came companies such as or projects such as Let's Encrypt that encrypted the web. We are using more kinds of end-to-end encrypted communication and so on. And this again shifted this balance between the cost of attack and defense. So this is constantly changing. It's not one fight, but because of mathematics, encryption, digital signatures, mixed nets, anonymity, zero knowledge proofs, and all these technologies, we can actually build pretty good and pretty cheap defense technology that is very costly to attack. Cryptography makes surveillance and censorship more expensive than the benefits. Bitcoin reduces the effectiveness of the monetary monopoly, which is quite horrible. That's not something that the Voli kings had. They were using precious metals as money, and now many people are being forced to use state currencies, and Bitcoin solved this problem and took away this like magic power of the central bank. We have at least technically the peer-to-peer infrastructure that eliminates central weaknesses and points of attack, again with the goal of reducing the benefits of the attack and increasing the cost. Like you can attack Facebook, you just come to them with a subpoena and say, okay, now you need to give me this information or block this person. If it's a peer-to-peer technology, this is much harder, and it's a constant fight, and it becomes costly from the point of view of the state. So it is much more difficult to attack a network than a hierarchy, because hierarchy has these central points that are high up in the hierarchy. And if you successfully attack the central point, then everything just crashes and the attack is successful. If it's a network, then the network itself might not be effective. It might be like quite painful to do things in peer-to-peer fashion. But the benefit is that the network can be either robust or in some cases even anti-fragile, as Amir was saying. So I want to invite you to look at this idea of the digital mountains. You don't have to climb a physical mountain. It is provided to us by cryptography. Think about this balance of cost of attack and defense, also with the drones and warfare and other things that are like that. There are many ways that these conflicts play out. Hopefully we don't have to deal with it in a military conflict, but it's good to be aware and see this dynamic, how it works. Like, if you need to spend much more money for an attack than your benefit, then it's not successful in the end. So in the before times, physical territory was enough, but today we are in the digital space, which is a new space for the mind. Do you know who used this term, by the way? It was in the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, which was first presented at the World Economic Forum, which is very funny. But we are creating these digital territories that are much harder to attack thanks to cryptography and all these things. The bad news is that freedom, liberty, they're constant evolutionary adaptation. So we need to change the strategy. So we need to, we can be inspired. We can think from the first principles of the costs and the benefits and how the game theory plays out. But we need to adapt constantly and improve and change based on how the evolution of the state parasite is, because they're not static. They're still evolving. I don't think it's a super, that it's like something that people figured out and have a special goal at attaining. I think it's more that, you know, China tries central bank digital currency, then, you know, Christine Lagarde is inspired because it works pretty well, and then she wants to implement it and so on. So I don't think it's like a big master plan that people met at World Economic Forum and said, oh, we are going to conquer the world with a digital currency. I think it's more evolutionary, and they're tinkering as well and trying things out and just get inspired. Unfortunately, Parasite has different dynamics, and it's not very pleasant for us. So the defense must change too. So endophile, just one little thing, and we can then talk about this if we have time. I have no idea. We have published this magazine that is called The Dark Forest. It has some other things, but it has this article about walking up the digital mountain. It's also beautifully made by Honza, and we will present it tomorrow at 1:20 p.m. Stage one. So the magazine is called The Dark Forest. If you want to see it, I have some around. And in this magazine, I also talk a little bit differently about this idea of the digital mountains and the rules. So the name of this this issue number zero is There Were Never Any Real Rules. So thank you very much. And I can answer a few questions if you want.
You were a cypherpunk a long time ago, and did you do anything different in your life since you learned about Zomia?
Yes, I am more into the invisibility part. I started to give much more attention to privacy. For me, it is not that, you know, I would block every tracking cookie or something like that, because the problem I have with, you know, privacy activism is people go like super hardcore, like I'm not going to send even a bit of information to anyone, then they, you know, can't order food, call a cab, you know, do anything. So what I did instead is, because of this dynamic between the state or states and me, I looked up, I realized what I want to protect myself, what aspects of my private life I want to protect. And then I've solved those really well. And I don't care that much. Like, okay, if it's a plugin that I install into browser and it just works, then okay, let's do it. But there are people who go crazy to like be super anonymous. I think it's not a good strategy. I think it's much easier. For example, if you want to do a project anonymously, you focus on staying anonymous within that one project, do it, release it, and then go on with your life. So I'm looking a little bit differently at privacy itself or anonymity in many cases. So and it's hard to because in order to figure out what you want to protect, you need to know how the information is used, how it can be misused, and what are you actually leaking and when. Like, people don't know how the financial system reporting works. I looked at the XML structure that they upload and I see, okay, so this is the information that every bank sends about me to the country where I have my tax residency. So I know what is actually sent, and then I can ask myself question, okay, am I okay with that? Do I want this to look differently or no? So this is very hard, because if you're not into technology, into privacy, you don't know. You, like most people, have no idea what kind of information is shared, how it works in the backend. So that's the hard part. But I think this is important to be strategic about it, to not be LARPing and like, oh, I have a Graphene without Google Play services and like I cannot live my life. It's not the goal. I want to make my life easier and better. So that was something that I've done. Any other questions?
Thanks for an interesting presentation. Let's take a concrete example. Now in the UK, they are planning to introduce mandatory digital IDs. So what would be the ideal strategy? Just to let them do it, you know, we don't do anything and then we'll create our environment. Eventually, they might get conscripted even if we are homeless, you know, but, you know, or to put up some resistance, you know, and at least try to delay it by, you know, 5 or 10 years. Every day counts. So what would you do in this situation?
I am not in favor of any collectivist solution, because the payoff of any kind of energy I invest in that is minuscule, and it actually can be negative. So if, let's say, I push back against digital IDs, first of all, even if I would be like a much bigger influencer than my 6,000 Twitter followers, which is nothing, basically, I would not be able to influence the outcome of this. And like, people say, oh, you need to educate and talk to people. Like, if you really measure the real effect of this kind of action, it is pretty low. And it can also be negative, because, you know, that crazy cypherpunk is pushing against digital IDs. He has to be whatever for child porn. Therefore, you know, we need to flip it and we need to like implement it hard. You know, that's the example. So these things like this, like lobbying and kind of making global changes can actually backfire very quickly. And you don't know in advance if you're actually helping the situation or not. So for me, the only thing I'm looking is individual strategies, but not only for me, but for people around me. So for me, this would be get another residency, maybe another passport. You know, also think about what the digital ID actually means. Maybe it's not a big problem in your situation based on your KPIs. You can be drafted into army without a digital ID. That's doesn't make much of a difference. You're already in a database. So for me, I only look at individual solutions, and they are usually not applicable for other people. You know, if someone is a doctor that only has a license to work in the UK, probably moving to Paraguay is not a very good option for them. But maybe they value the fact that they get out of surveillance state or state that doesn't benefit them more. So maybe they will go and open a restaurant. So it's possible, but it's very individual. I don't believe there is any kind of like a global solution that you can, you know, delay something. No, just first thing, get your life in order. Make sure you're ready for unexpected events. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty. So you might be seen as a prepper by your family. You know, you're buying canned foods, you're getting a residency, you're saving in cryptocurrencies. You are there are like many many things that not only might seem an overkill, but be an overkill. But because we live in the presence of uncertainty, we don't know how shit hitting the fan actually looks like. So it's basically, for me, it's taking the suboptimal route for the most probable outcome, but acceptable or positive for the set of all possible outcomes. So I don't look at the most probable. I look what could happen in many areas of my life. That's why the KPIs. And I try to make sure that I'm at least okay with them. Like, there are no perfect solutions that, you know, now I'm free because I do these five things. It might be messy, it might decrease my quality of life, but it's much better than not doing anything and just waiting if some lobbying effort pans out and they don't introduce the digital ID. But I think we are already in databases, multiple databases. So for me, like, having a chip with a digital ID is not that much of a stretch. I have a few residencies and I can watch this from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean if I want. So thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to the recording of my talk at Dark Prague. I suggest you check out the Dark Forest zine that I mentioned in the beginning of this podcast. It is at darkfo.rest, or you can find us on Nostra. And this magazine is brought to you by Peter Horvath, No Good Kid, and Bitpunk FM. So I hope you enjoyed both the podcast, and I hope you will enjoy the zine. Thank you very much.